Welcome to Stand to Reasons, hashtag STRAsk podcast. I'm Amy Hall. I'm here with Greg Kokel, and we welcome you to the show. Thanks for listening. And thanks for sending in your questions. We need questions from you, so send in your questions on Twitter with the hashtag STRAsk. Or you can do what a lot of people have been doing lately, which is sending their questions through our website, through the contact page. And in your question, choose I have another question, and then just put hashtag STRAsk, all one word, in your question, and it goes straight into a folder that I look through, and I use those questions as well. So everyone can participate. If you have a question, send it in, and we'd love to see it.
Hi, Amy.
Hi, Greg.
Why does it seem like it's been so long since we've done this? I know everybody's getting this week to week, but we haven't sat down together like this, even though digitally, in over a month, right?
Yeah, it's been over a month. You've been writing and you've been away.
I've been away. It's amazing how the days get eaten up with all kinds of things that weren't part of your original plan. You know, I saw on TV once a movie. It was just channel surfing many years ago, black and white movie. And two people were talking, a man and a woman. And he read something and it said, life is like a diary in which you mean to write one story, but you write another. Mm-hmm. I thought that was really profound. I guess it's a variation of life is what happens when you're making other plans. That's John Lennon, but I like the older one better. Your life is like a diary in which you mean to write one story, but you write another.
Well, that's better than insightful. That's better than what I thought of, Greg, which was an episode of Dick Van Dyke where he goes up to this cabin so he can get away from all the distractions to write his book. And he ends up, you know, playing with the paddleboard and doing all these different things in there.
The paddleball, right.
The paddleball, yes.
Wasting time. Can't get going. I do remember that episode. It's not quite like that, but it's just other things. You know, I got emails coming in. I got red pen logic problems come up. Issues happen. New developments and current events. Radio shows still while I was up there. Mm-hmm. And then banging away at other writing. And so consequently, I never did anything on the book and didn't even finish Solid Ground, which I'm still laboring away at. But that should be in the next day or two for the November Solid Ground. So, anyway.
Yeah, you were still writing, at least.
Life is like a diary. I was working.
Yes.
Here we are, ready to rock and roll.
Okay. Let's look at a question from Lainey. When I see the children of really smart pastors and other Christian leaders fall away, then it seems hopeless for me. Do you have any suggestions for things parents can do to help ensure their children continue in the faith?
Yes, I do, but I want to make another observation. This, in a certain odd sense, is an example of special pleading, where you kind of only are looking at one side of the issue, okay? The fact is, there are all kinds of godless parents, I guess like mine, when you think about it, that produce children who love the Lord and are being productive for the Lord. Now, my parents came to know Christ later, but my upbringing wasn't... It wasn't profoundly spiritual, and when I became a teenager, I went my own way during the mid-60s. So, for a number of years. So you have things happening in both sides of that equation, so to speak, and one ought not be discouraged because their children don't go. Let me put it this way: their children may go astray from the Lord. In fact, that's the case for me with one of my children. Now, I have looked back on my own life and have thought about this dynamic, and I have some ideas about what people can do that will help. I do know, you know, Christian Smith, who did that incredible study in 2005 about the shallowness of teenage Christians' faith. He also did another study since then talking about this particular question. And he said the most important thing for the durability of the children's faith convictions is the durability and consistency of the parents' faith convictions. In other words, it's not just talk. They are living out in their individual lives and the way they comport themselves as a family and the way they do things in other environments. They are living out their Christian convictions. he said it's almost deterministic, is the way Christian Smith put it. I think it's like 85, it's north of 85% of parents who live their faith consistently produce children who have spiritual stability. Okay? So that's one big thing. Be sure, if whatever else you're doing, you are living your life consistently as a God-fearing, virtue-pursuing follower of Jesus, okay, number one. Secondly, what I would say, just in my own experience, is that you develop patterns to nurture the spiritual lives of your children early, whatever those patterns happen to be. Whether they're reading or praying together or studying or watching things or whatever it happens to be, 15 minutes after dinner time. And by the way, that's a good thing too, have meals together at the table, not in front of the TV set. That's one of the single most effective predictors of the stability of children growing up, that their families met together as a family and had dinner. The dynamic is very different when that's the case. And I notice when we do that, and I'm trying to do that more and more because we have an odd dynamic in our house. When we do that, it changes everything. So having that as a regular thing, and then having devotions, whatever you want to call it, afterwards, some pattern of reading or discussing or some particular thing. But my point is, it's got to be a discipline. That is, it has to be very consistent, because we never had that in our family. We just didn't. And I tried it a number of times, but it just, mea culpa. I'm just saying. I wish I had been more persistent earlier on. Okay. And it's really important, by the way, that mom and dad are both on board with this. They are on board, not in sentiment, but in practical application. All right. So that's critical. So that's big. I think going to church regularly on Sunday is kind of obvious, but let me just say that. But having this personal time with your family where you're going through material. Natasha Crane has done a great job in putting together some books like Keeping Your Kids on God's Side and others that are meant to give parents the tools to have small sessions, short, accessible, not burdensome, turnkey sessions with their children to train them in the things of the Lord. Okay? So I would say that as I look back at my own life, the thing that I would really want, I should have done. I just should have. I'm out of town, and so blah, blah, blah. So regardless, if you want to have stability spiritually in your family, build in regular times, spiritual times. And you could be listening to things, you could be reading things, you could be talking about things, you could be reading scripture around the table, half a chapter of Proverbs, whole chapter is too much, just half a chapter, and people read around, you talk a little bit about it, 10, 15 minutes, and off you go. Not overwhelming, not burdensome, but kids need to get into the habit that this is a regular part of your spiritual life. All right. So those things, for one, living out your Christianity as parents consistently, one. Two, having a regular time with, for the lack of a better word, family devotions and family prayer consistently that you start early with. And what I mean here is the kids should never be able to remember a time when this wasn't part of your family life. You can start late, but it's a lot harder, okay? And then having meals together, even if you don't use them for spiritual ends, having meals together as a family, and then regular church attendance. I mean, it's in a way, it's like, that was not very profound, Kokel. You're right. Most of these things that build stability in our spiritual life are not secrets. They are not profound. Some things that are, in a sense, new are tools like Natasha Crane's works that will help us to accomplish that. But the idea of, making sure our kids understand these things is not new. And, you know, I remember reading an older, watching an older movie, like in the 30s or something like that. And there was an older man that was addressing a younger man, like a young teenager. And he said, you know your scriptures, right? And he says, yes. And so he makes a point from scripture. He says something about Daniel or David or whatever. But notice the assumption, even in that period of time, that kids understood the scriptures. They had been exposed to it enough that they knew these different things because it was a regular part of their life. Watch, the 1951 version of Christmas Carol with Alistair Sim. Here you have looking into the future. Tiny Tim is gone. And what are they doing? The one boy is reading to the rest of the family from Psalm 91. This is a standard part of their life. Okay, this is like, 19th century stuff, but that was just built in. So anyway, build it in. That would be my suggestion.
So the thing that I wanted to comment on in this question is Lainey's asking, she's talking about the children of really smart pastors falling away. And I just want to point out that this is not a matter of smarts. This is not an intellectual issue. This is a spiritual issue. And every single person starts off as a rebel against God. By nature, children of God's wrath. So it's as difficult or as easy for God to save a rebellious child as it is for him to save a compliant child. Everyone starts off in rebellion against God. So you don't have to worry that you're not smart enough or you're not intellectual enough or whatever, because the problem is mainly spiritual. Now, on the one hand, that's encouraging because it means you don't have to be the smartest person in the world for your child to be saved. On the other hand, it's a little discouraging because you ultimately cannot make your child be saved, no matter what you do. Now, of course, he uses means, so that's why you create these habits and you create this awareness of who God is, and God uses those means to reveal himself to people. So this is all important, but ultimately, God has to make it happen. So it's not... You cannot make your child be saved. And so, again, this is
right.
This means that you need to pray, because ultimately it will be something that God will do through all these things that you're doing to build up in your child an awareness of who God is and what the gospel is and the fact that he's real and true. But this is not any – you can be the smartest person in the world. You can be the least smart person in the world. Your child can be saved. Your child can be saved by God, because with man, this is impossible. But with God, all things are possible.
Right. That's well said, Amy. I'm glad you emphasized that, because the question that is raised applies in my own family life as well. And I think I've said this before on the air that right now what's important for me is not to convince my teenage daughter of my view, but it's to convince her of my love. And that in these years it's the most important. I might have been able to do a better job of convincing her of my view early on. But given the aggressiveness of the culture and what iPhones do to kids and all of that other stuff, it's Las Vegas right there in their hands, It's just wild. There are a lot more challenges than we've ever faced before. We do not have a cooperative culture, and in many instances, we don't have a cooperative church in terms of the things that local churches are teaching nowadays. So that's all working against us. What we can do is be faithful in our own lives before the Lord, so that's visibly for others. We can do what we can to establish patterns, discipline patterns in our family life that are not burdensome, but feed our children on a regular basis. And then we have to entrust them to the Lord, just as you've said, Amy, because individuals make... J. Warner Wallace's dad is still an atheist, all right? John Piper's son is an atheist. That just goes to show that being clever and smart is no guarantee that, and having good arguments and all that other stuff is no guarantee that a person is going to abandon their rebellious ways. That's between them and God, and that's where we should leave it. And that's why mm-hmm. prayer is so important at this juncture.
Let's take a question from John D. Should Christians be concerned by how often NDEs don't seem to correspond or line up with much of what we are taught, theologically speaking, about the afterlife, God, heaven, hell, etc.? Does it call into question the Bible's veracity? Why or why not?
Yeah, NDEs are near-death experiences, and classically people have an episode where they die in some sense. They call them near-death because they return, but by different clinical standards, they're actually dead. Yet when they return, they recount experiences they've had of going to heaven, characteristically occasionally going to hell. But there is such a plethora of these experiences that demonstrate diversity, and many of them don't seem to match up with, like the questioner asked, what the scripture says. So what do we make of that? And the answer is that I think we ought to be very, very careful. Even the Christian accounts seem to be inconsistent in many ways. When I say Christian, I mean these so-called, even when people who identify as Christians have these experiences and say, here's what I saw when I went to heaven. Oh, like that little boy, for example. I can't remember his name, but there's a lot of these. And they sell a lot of books because they're sensationalistic. I think what we ought to do is take our cues from what heaven is like from God and not from other people's experiences. The same thing is true about any religious truth. Okay, there are times when people's experience is compatible with what Scripture says, and I'm thinking one in particular that I've read that I thought, and I can't even remember the title of it, so I won't recommend it. I have it, but I remember J.P. Moreland recommending it, and I thought this is one of those things that seem to comport more than any others with the scriptural details that we have of the afterlife. But many of them are farcical, and they support other worldviews. And one of the things that Gary Habermas, who has researched this quite a bit, has said about that is people see things in these NDEs, and then they interpret them in light of their own background. So they might see a divine-type figure, or one that looks like a divine figure. Well, if they're Christians, they're going to say, I saw Jesus. But if they're Hindus, they're going to say, I saw Krishna. You know, so that it's not as if the experience itself in every case is self-interpreting, but rather one has the experience and has to interpret it for himself, and so their own biases are going to come through. So you're going to get this wide variety of things. Gary, who is a very careful researcher, doesn't make draw any conclusions about the content of what people experience. All right, no theological conclusions. He draws conclusions about the implications of NDEs for worldviews. So if one has an out-of-body experience that is veridical, in other words, it's true, it actually took place, and can be demonstrated to have been the case through evidence, so it's evidentially substantiated, like remote viewing, where a person leaves their location, goes somewhere else, sees something that they would not have known about, returns, and then tells people about it when they come back, too. Well, I went around the hospital and saw this red shoe on the top of the hospital, or I went back home and everybody's eating chicken and dumplings, and here's the conversation they had. Well, none of this would have been available to them in the natural. And what this does is gives clear evidence that there is a soul that's separate from the human body, and so naturalism, in virtue of that testimony, would be refuted. And that's where Gary goes with that. But he doesn't go much farther than that. So, except to make the point that there is an afterlife, because sometimes there are experiences that people have with others on the other side who they don't know are dead. But when they come back, they talk about it, and then they learn later, those people just died or died earlier and there was no knowledge of it. So that's another point of verification that there is an afterlife, but the nature of the afterlife is still an open question from Gary's perspective based on NDEs. But it is not an open question from Gary's perspective based on Scripture.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the pecking order.
And it's hard to know exactly what people are seeing when they're not actually they're separated from their body, but this isn't their final death. They come back. So we don't know exactly where they've been or what they've seen or who's been talking to them. Like we don't know any of those things. So I think you're right, Greg. We learn that your mind can be separated from your body, that it can outlive your body. And that's the main thing that we, that's the main mm-hmm. thing that we learn from this. So I think Gary mm-hmm. Habermas's approach is a good one here.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of the book. He and J.P. Moreland wrote a book called...
I think it's Beyond Death.
There's another one. They did the same book twice with different titles. I think the original title was Immortality with Thomas Nelson, and then Beyond Death was the same material, expanded now, especially the NDE section, by Gary's contribution to that book. So probably... Beyond Death is the title that people can get now, and it's really it's great. It's a great book.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Greg, and thank you, Lainey and John, for your questions. We appreciate hearing from you. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.